Okay, tonight is Wednesday night, November 8th. This is the women's Gemara or Mishnah share. We're up to Maseches Chulin. We're in the 8th perek of Chulin. We're doing the sugya tonight of Nosein Tam Livgam.
Okay, Rabotai.
Hey.
Okay, Rabotai. Tonight we're going to see one of the most famous issues in the world of Kashrut. And its title is Notein Ta'am Livgam. What is the source of it? Not everyone agrees that Notein Ta'am Livgam is permissible. There's a machlokes of Tanaim. And we're going to see its initial development in the Gemara and then proceed to see how the Shulchan Aruch records this particular halacha. So, and the Gemara starts off in an unusual way where we are discussing not necessarily plain ta'am, but even the item itself, be'en. If I have a piece of nevela meat and it tastes horrible, does that mean you're allowed to eat it? Because it has forfeited its taste as a piece of meat. It's so spoiled, spoiled. So if you decided to be nuts and eat spoiled meat, so in addition to getting sick, you'll also violate a law on that. That's the way the situation begins initially, and then we'll move over to the more practical and common case about nitinat ta'am, where the taste, the residue taste, might be good or bad. So this is Avodah Zarah, Daf Samach Zayin Amud Bet. This is the primary source in Maseches Avodah Zarah. The Gemara says, Bahatanya, we learned in a Braita, Echad notein tam livgam, ve'echad notein tam lishvach, asur, divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says, whether something which is prohibited, such as a piece of nevela meat, whether it has tam, which is detrimental, it's spoiled, it tastes horribly, or it tastes great, lishvach, it has a great enhanced taste, both of them are prohibited. Both of them are prohibited. That's Rabbi Meir's opinion. Rabbi Shimon Omer, lishvach asur, vilifgam mutar. Rabbi Shimon says that if the taste is a good one, shvach, enhanced, a good taste, under those circumstances it is prohibited. But if it's lifgam, if it is detrimental, and I am only exaggerating because I like to exaggerate, I said that it's totally spoiled. But technically, the definition of lifgam does not mean it's totally spoiled. It means that it seems to be going. It's not, doesn't taste like a good piece of steak. Okay? Or if you have, it's a little, I don't know if, I don't, maybe you can tell the difference, I don't know. You know, whether the meat is about, it's on its way to be spoiled. You know, I can taste it by milk. No. Milk is
a very... deli.
What?
I think with deli meats you can taste.
Deli meats, yeah, you can taste? Okay.
I think so.
Okay. So, but with milk it's very easy. You can see it's not totally spoiled, but it's, you can sense it. It's on its way. So that application applies to all foods, and that is already considered notein tam livgam. It does not have to be totally ruined. It just has to be somewhat detrimental, somewhat less than the norm. If it has a decreased taste, which which is not obviously to its benefit, so that Rabbi Shimon permits. That type of time, Rabbi Shimon permits. So the Gemara is going to try to understand what is the halachic basis of their debate. What is the kernel of their debate? Asks the Gemara, my ta'ama, memtet is an abbreviation for my ta'ama. Many times in the Gemaras, as we've seen before, they use abbreviations and expect you to know it. My ta'ama de Rabbi Meir. What is the reason for Rabbi Meir's opinion? Answers the Gemara, Gomar me ge'ule ovde kochavim. Ge'ule ovde kochavim lav no tein tam livgamu. V'osarachmana. Osarachmana. Here is what's happening. Am Yisrael, as they travel in the desert, approach the city of Moab after they had encountered Sichon Melech HaEmori and Og Melech HaBashan. And what happened was, these were powerful kings. Everybody knows that Og is a famous biblical figure. Many places his roots in the time of Noah and the flood. And he's around at the end of Moshe's life in year 40. So he's lived 210 years. He's lived a couple of hundred years. Anyhow, he's a powerful dude. So after he is handily defeated by Am Yisrael, Moab engages Bilam from the country of Midian to curse Am Yisrael. That's what he does. And as a result, HaKadosh Baruch Hu ultimately instructs Moshe, who appoints Elazar, the Kohen, to lead Am Yisrael in battle against the people of Midian, in order to seek revenge of the fact that they tried to hurt and ultimately annihilate Am Yisrael by joining forces with the king of Moab. So that's described at the end of Sefer Bamidbar and Parshat Matot. After the battle takes place, which we won decisively, Moshe tells Am Yisrael what are they supposed to do with all of the silverware and pots that they captured from the Midianites. So the topic is called Giule Midian, the remnants of the Midianites. What do you do with it? So all of the laws of kashering are learned from this particular parsha. So the Torah says, Kol asher yavo ba'esh, ba'esh ta'aviru. Anything whose primary use is directly over a fire, such as a spit, a barbecue, in order to kasher it, you have to apply it to fire. It requires libun. Libun is the halachic process where you actually expose something to fire. However, v'chol asher lo yavo bo'esh, anything that does not have its primary use over fire, but rather it's used to cook something, you take a pot and you put water in it and you put the item into the pot and that's how you cook it. You don't take the item, the food, and put it directly over the fire, but it's in a pot of water. So how do you kasher that? By a hagalah, which is a pot of water, boiling hot water. So there, he expresses the opinion, does Rabbi Meir, knowing that we're supposed to assume that after 24 hours, what happens to any taste that would be purged from the knife that I have just taken conquest of from the Midianites, or from the pot? What taste is lodged inside this pot or in this knife? What type of taste? Not treif, non-kosher food. But do you think that the Midianites used this within the last 24 hours? Probably not. We were at battle, and they have to take all the stuff home from battle. And I don't think they ran from battle to the kitchen to start using those pots. So the assumption is made that what? That you have to kosher the pot and the knives and so on and so forth. Well, why? Isn't the taste that will ultimately be purged lifgam? Because we know that at least 24 hours have lapsed since the last time the Midianites used this pottery or silverware for what? For cooking something that was not kosher. And yet, what does the Torah tell Elazar to do? And all of Am Yisrael? You have to kosher it. Why do I have to kosher it? The taste that will come out is undoubtedly not going to enhance my roast, my potatoes. It's not. Because after 24 hours, there is a given. No one argues with that. That the taste that is purged after 24 hours is lifgam. Is detrimental. So why do I have to kosher it? Says Rabbi Meir, apparently, if you're dealing with something that was what? That was initially prohibited, like nevela, trefa meat, that no matter how far or how horrible it tastes, it remains asur. Something that was by definition asur, that we don't care how minute it is, we don't care how weak the taste is, the item itself remains asur. And therefore, in order to purge that taste, what do you have to do? You have to do whatever the Torah tells you, either place it over a fire or boil up water. That's Rabbi Meir's opinion. And therefore, there will be a huge difference between what our topic primarily is, basar b'chalav. If I cook meat, kosher meat, which I assume is in all of your pots, that taste that will be purged will be able to become mutar because it was not initially something prohibited. It was kosher meat. So what might create the isur that this weakened kosher meat will now mix with what? With milk. So there we take all kinds of leniencies because the original absorption was something that was mutar, something that was permissible. And that rule is going to become critical for us as we will explore other cases. That's what Rabbi Meir says. Hachanami loshna. Here, I don't, and therefore as well, I happen to say that all notain tam lifgam, where the original absorption was a davar ha'asur, I don't particularly care how terrible the subsequent taste is. It's 100% asur and remains 100% asur. Right. So that's what he says. So if somebody asks you, what is the source of Rabbi Meir? You answer, Bamidbar, chapter 27 or 28. The topic is called Giulei Midyan. Learned out from the Midyan experience. Okay, the Gemara will deviate a little, but I want to stay focused, so skip to the second to the last line and go to Rabbi Shimon Maita Ama. Rabbi Shimon, who says that notain tam lifgam is permissible. Why does he say it's permissible? Desanya, we learned in the Braita. The Torah writes in Sefer Devarim, chapter 14 of Sefer of Devarim, Lo tochlu kol nevela. You are not permitted to eat any nevela meat. You know what nevela meat means. It means the animal died from anything but a kosher shechita. That is nevela. The animal itself is kosher. It's a kosher species. It has no defects in it. It's a perfectly smooth lung. It has everything. It's glatt meat. It's glatt. Because that's what glatt means. The lung is perfectly smooth. That's all glatt means. Doesn't mean that there's higher supervision. That's the way it's misused. But the word glatt in Shulchan Aruch means that there are no abrasions, no lesions in the neck area, in the lungs, where frequently there are such lesions and abrasions. This is perfectly smooth. Chalak. That's what the Sfardim call it. Chalak. They don't call it glatt because they don't say Yiddish. They say chalak. That's what it is. And for the Sfardim, it's not a chumrah. It's one of the few times that Karo is more stringent than Ramah. The Ramah allows us to use, if there are certain abrasions and lesions, that's kosher meat. Many of us might remember that we ate kosher meat all the time, even though it was not glatt. Glatt was a rarity if you had a butcher that had glatt. And in fact, the whole glatt business is the biggest financial ripoff in the history of Am Yisrael. Because there isn't enough glatt meat to satisfy the consumer. It just isn't. Factually, most animals do not have completely smooth lungs. So they're selling you meat which they call glatt, rip you off, and it's better than regular kosher. Fine. So
Zayin Azayin. They're not glatt and they call them glatt.
What?
Chickens are not glatt either.
Yeah, of course. And chickens don't have any non-glatt issues. But anyhow, people call dairy places glatt kosher too. Yeah, sure. Because the cheese is perfectly smooth. It's not Swiss cheese. Swiss cheese as a whole can't be glatt.
That's a,
right. Right. So now, the Torah says, what are you supposed to do with Nevela? Sephardic ask you, what are you supposed to do with Nevela? You can't eat it. However, here the Torah stipulates that you are allowed to have a benefit from it. The Torah writes, Lager asher bisharecha titnena va'achala. You can give it to the stranger, and there it means a ger toshav, not a ger tzedek, not a regular convert, but it means a ger toshav. You're living in Israel, and the person is a decent person. He doesn't steal. He observes Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, and he pays taxes to Medinat Yisrael. Mm-hmm. So you're supposed to give it to him.
Or an animal.
Yes, of course. But you can even give it to a person. And you can all machur l'nachri, the Torah says. Or you can sell it. You can give it as a gift, or sell it and make a profit. So the Gemara's drash is, kol hareuya liger kruya nevela. Whatever is suitable, re'uya means suitable, ra'uy, suitable for this Gentile, that's called nevela. In other words, would you ever give a gift to a Gentile of a piece of meat that's rotten? Of course not.
That's what?
That's rotten?
No.
Of course not. Therefore, if it is rotten, if it doesn't taste good, it's not defined as nevela. In order to define something as nevela, it has to be re'uya liger. Re'uya liger. Go to the next page, page 2. She'ena re'uya liger, eina kruya nevela. She'en re'uya liger, if it is not worthy of giving to a ger toshav, a Gentile neighbor of yours, that's not called nevela. I don't know what you call it, but it's not called nevela.
Would that be called pagan?
No, so that's yeah, of course it's no tain, it's spoiled, that's so it's no tain tam lufgam. That's how he knows that if it has a spoiled taste, you're allowed to eat it. Why is the Rabbi Shimon say you're allowed to eat it? Because it's not prohibited. What is prohibited? Nevela. Lo tochal kol nevela. This is not called nevela. It's called plastic. It's called cardboard.
You're still not allowed to eat it, correct?
Yes, you are.
But it's spoiled. You wouldn't give it to a...
Okay. Would you violate an isur if you eat it? They'll come and visit you for the remedy. If you didn't listen.
Well, you might violate
that's
the
all. Isur. They'll come and visit you when they got sick, but they won't violate an Isur d'oraisa.
No.
Yes.
Nevela has a very specific definition. He said it's something that wasn't shafted.
Good.
So why are we trying to define it again and saying if it's ena ruya lager, then it's ena?
Well, he's saying both sides. If it is in order, something which is ruya lager is called a nevela. Something which is not. We do that all the time.
Why are we defining a nevela based on whether it's ruya lager or not?
Because that's what his drash is. That since the Torah says lager asher tit. So what are you supposed to be giving to, what defines this prohibition which you are now allowed to eat, which you are now giving to what? To a Gentile. What? A piece of nevela. But if it's so bad that you wouldn't give it to a Gentile, it forfeits its identity as nevela. It's not nevela.
It's a subgroup.
Call it, no, call it any. It's not, it's not spoiled meat. That's just it. It's not nevela. Nevela is an meat from an animal that died from anything but a kosher shechita. This is not called nevela, even though it was a meat from an animal that died from a non-kosher shechita. But it's not called nevela,
right,
because it has forfeited its taste. And as I said before you walked in, it doesn't have to be completely ruined. If it's on its way to becoming ruined, it already forfeits its... You were here? Oh, okay. Sorry. It already forfeits its identity under those circumstances. So the Gemara asks the Rabbi Meir, what does Rabbi Meir say about this? How would he respond to this? How would he respond? It seems to be a compelling argument of his good friend Rabbi Shimon. Answers the Gemara, Hahu limute srucha meikara. Hahu limute srucha meikara. This refers to meat that was spoiled the minute the animal died. Right away. At the minute the animal died. So let's assume the animal had a disease. And now it was killed. And now as you cut up the meat, you see that it's discolored, whatever it is. That says Rabbi Meir, I agree with my friend Shimon, you're allowed to eat that. Should you so desire, and will not violate the prohibition of lo kol chal kol nevela. When am I talking about something that was initially perfect cut of meat, but then over time it lost its taste? That's when I say, since it was asur initially, it remains asur leolam va'ed. This piece of meat, which you, Rabbi Shimon, are talking about, is talking about it never enjoyed the status of a good piece of meat. That, I agree, if you want to be nuts and eat such a diseased piece of meat, be my guest. You're not going to violate the law of nevela. But where it was a, you know, filet mignon, it was a very good piece of steak, and they charge you New York prices for that steak, $50 for a steak or more. Under those circumstances, even if it goes a little bad, I believe notain tam livgam is asur. That's Rabbi Meir's response. Yes.
What if that piece of meat, which was such a good piece of meat, was originally a kosher piece of meat, but it was cooked, say, in butter. It became treif because
okay.
It was good. Then what happens to this pot?
Okay, now we'll ask the question. When did you cook something in butter? You cooked the meat with the butter?
The meat was cooked supposedly.
So you know the answer to that. It's a great piece. You know the answer, tell me. You tell me about the status of the pot right now. Tell me. Of course. It's asur. Why? Because it has ta'am of basar b'chalav in it. That's correct. It does. But here, he might say, since the meat which you put in initially was what? Kosher meat. Now, if the residue taste coming out of this wall will be lifgam, I will allow you to eat the next product that's cooked in there. Because under those circumstances, he might hold no saying tam lifgam is mutter. It's only, he initially, Rabbi Meir, only prohibits if the item, the first item, the original item, the one creating the problem, was a davar ha'asur. We said that principle when we had the first shiur of the eighth perek, that was unique about basar b'chalav. Basar b'chalav, remember that, is a unique prohibition. Right, because each one of the ingredients are permissible. So there are different guidelines for basar b'chalav as opposed to mixtures of everything else. That's why there are two different simanim in Shulchan Aruch. There are the laws of ta'aruvot, of mixture, kosher and non-kosher, and then there are the laws of basar b'chalav. Because there are many different criteria based on that fact. That you're dealing with something that was basically kosher, and only in combination is it asur. When you have a piece of trefa meat, when you have a piece of nevela meat, or you have something that is not a kosher animal, or not a kosher fish, whatever it is, under those circumstances, you're dealing with something which is asur initially. Therefore, it has many, many more stringencies. Many, many more stringencies. That's the primary argument. Then, of course, the same argument applies on a ta'am basis. Not if I want to eat the nevela that's gone bad. I cooked a piece of nevela meat in a pot. Perfectly good piece of nevela meat. And now 24 hours lapsed. And now I cook my kosher piece of meat. There as well is the machloikis Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Meir says, I don't care how little taste will be purged from the walls or what quality will be purged from that wall. I couldn't care less. Even if the time is totally detrimental, I'm making chocolate pudding. I don't want to have a meaty taste in my chocolate pudding. So will this meat that once cooked in my pot, will the nevela meat, is that going to enhance the flavor of the chocolate pudding or make it detrimental? Probably detrimental. Says Rabbi Meir, I couldn't care less. You are not allowed to eat that chocolate pudding. Because the original item was a davar ha'asur. But if I cook kosher meat there, kosher meat, and now I cook my chocolate pudding, there the detrimental taste, because I waited 24 hours to cook the chocolate pudding after I had my kosher meat, there Rabbi Meir might agree with Rabbi Shimon that notain tam lifgam is permissible. Because we started off with nothing that in essence was a prohibited object. So this is a double machloikis between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon. Initially it starts off with the items themselves, which are spoiled or not spoiled, and then it transfers over to taste. Transfers over to taste. And Rabbi Meir's point is that no matter how small that taste is going to be, that davar ha'asur will never become batel, will never become batel in the chocolate pudding. When I started with a piece of nevela meat, even if it's a horrible taste, the fact that I can taste it at all says to me, what am I eating at this time? What am I eating at this time? Nevela meat. And I'm not going to allow a Jew or Jewess to eat nevela meat, says Rabbi Meir. I'm not. Under any circumstances. If beefsteak tasted it and there was no meat taste in the chocolate pudding, then everybody's going to say it's permissible. Because there's no nesinas tam at all. If there is no nesinas tam, what doesn't exist? There's no trefa meat. There's no nevela meat here. So the whole halacha of notain tam lifgam is predicated upon the fact that someone identified a meaty taste in the chocolate pudding. Someone identified. So now I have a problem. Rabbi Meir says it's asur, if it's even if it's detrimental. Rabbi Shimon only says if the flavor is enhanced by the meaty quality. But if it's to its detriment, I believe that all no saint tam livgam is essentially permissible.
But yes. Going back to a previous point, and we did this last week. If kosher meat in a pot, wash it out thoroughly, whatever, 24 hours, you can use that same pot for dairy?
Lechatchila, no. Because as we will see, we paskin, I didn't say anything about paskin, because you know I'm not interested in that now, that notain tam lefgam is only mutter bidi eved, if it was already done. I said that.
Right.
But lichatchila,
you can't have one set of pots knowing that...
That is correct. I'll take it one step further, and I'll show it to you in the Magen Avraham. You're not allowed to have one set of pots even if you kosher it every single time.
And what would that mean, kosher?
Oh, I mean kosher. I cooked the meat in it, and now I waited 24 hours, as you're supposed to do before you kosher something, and I filled it up with hot water, and it purged, boiled over. It's kosher. It's neutral.
Why not?
Because we're afraid that one time you're going to be in a rush, and you're not going to kosher it, and what are you just going to do? Going to clean it out and cook with it.
You'll forget which one you kosher and which one.
Exactly. So the only time, remember, is that's correct. The only time that you're allowed to kosher something and then use it for something else is in the context of Pesach. So, and here, listen to this. If you're koshering something for Pesach, you're allowed to change it from dairy to meat and meat to dairy as well. Once you're koshering it for Pesach, then you can make the one-time change. But during the course of the year, even if you're kosher, you cannot cook the opposite thing in it.
So I once asked you, if you have a utensil, or let's say like I had like an immersion pot, whatever it was, I didn't remember if it was mechik or fleshik.
Yeah.
So do I have to throw it out?
No.
So why am I allowed to
kosher? Wait till Pesach. Kosher it for Pesach.
I have to wait till Pesach.
That is correct. That's correct. Or you can use it for parv.
So you can kosher my kitchen.
Once you, if you take something that's chametz and you're koshering it for Pesach, once you kosher it for Pesach, you can also change its designation from meat to dairy or dairy to meat. But during the course of the year, even if you kosher a pot, you cannot make it the other one.
And it's for that reason, because you won't have that problem because you once a year, so you're not going to.
That's great, because for Pesach, once you change it, that's it. Yeah. Wait, yes.
Just remind me again the whole Tom thing. I always forget what the reference is when we go by Tom as a.
Because there are a couple of sources for it. One was, we learned this in Masechet Nazir. The Torah tells a Nazir not to drink wine, not to eat grapes. Wine grapes, and not to eat mishrat anavim. What is mishrat anavim? You have some cake, and somewhere inside is what? Wine is one of the recipes. He's not drinking wine, because what's going to happen? He's going to have the taste of the wine. So that with it, that's one of the possible sources. The ta'am ki ikar. The ta'am is what? Like the item itself. That's one of the primary sources.
It's not really about kosher in that case. It's more about stringency that he's taking.
But it's not a stringency. It's his stringency. But why did the Torah tell him he's not permitted to eat that cake?
Because it's wine. It's wine itself.
But it's not. You don't see wine. You don't make a bari pri agafen on this piece of cake.
I guess, but it's still like...
You know, no, it just has the taste. It just has the... So say the same thing. What?
I'm saying people put those kind of things in, like people make a rum cake and it has the liquid.
Okay, well that's the idea of it. Yeah. It has the taste. So the taste is something essential.
Yeah.
So if the taste is essential, the same thing is true by non-kosher products. Mm-hmm. That taste is identifiable.
What was the other source?
Yeah, there's another one. This Geule Midyan is another one. A couple of possibilities. Good.
Can I ask you a question with the Pesach thing for 1 second? So, you know how you can make your glasses also, like you do Chagallah for 3 days? So
yeah, that's... a nice little idea, but there is absolutely there is a basis, quoting Shulchan Aruch, but it's no conceptual basis for understanding it. Because nowhere have we ever come and seen that the taste of something can be purged by soaking it in cold water for 24 hours.
3 days.
For 3 days. We've never seen that. It happens to be quoted by, there is a piyut, a poem. If you, I don't think you'll ever, I don't give a daven in a shul, maybe your father probably did. Daven in a shul, where they said Yotz wrote on Shabbos HaGadol. In many shuls, Parshas Shkolim, Parshas Zachar, Parshas Para, Parshas Achodesh, and Shabbos HaGadol, in the Chazarat HaShatz of Shachris, and for Shkolim and Achodesh, for Musaf as well, during the repetition of the Amidah, there are poems that are recited. Yotz wrote. Just like we do on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It's the only time we all say these poems in the middle of the Chazaras Hashat. But there are many people who say it those Shabbatot. There is one poem on Shabbat HaGadol which is written by one of the Rishonim. His name is Rabbi Yosef Tov Elam. And he wrote all of Hilchot Pesach in poetic form. Everything. From how to clean your house, how to kosher things, and what you have to do with the Seder. It's a really nice poem. It's simple Hebrew. It's four words for each halacha. He's only got four words, and he can, in poetic fashion, all perfectly rhyming. That's what he did. And in his poem, it says that if you want klei zechuchit, you change the water every 3 days. And he, what? So he obviously heard of it. He's an Ashkenazic scholar. His name is Rabbi Yosef Tov Elam. He's quoted by the tour quite frequently in the Beis Yosef. But he mentions that already in his thing. But conceptually, we have no understanding of it. Because if it's a glass and it's used for cold, why do you have to kosher it in the first place? And if you have to kosher it, like I said, soaking cold water and changing the water doesn't accomplish anything. Doesn't accomplish anything. But we do it because that's what my grandmother did.
I'm just asking.
What?
It seems like if you're already doing it, then you should be able to make those glasses that we put in the fleshy dishwasher and designate them as fleshy. You should be able to switch them to
milk. No, but it only works for Pesach.
I'm saying on Pesach, when you're doing those 3 days, could you make those glasses now not only...
No.
That's what I was asking.
No, of course not.
I know.
Because if it has... No, but it doesn't really work. It doesn't accomplish anything.
We're using it for Pesach. When
it's because it doesn't need any kashering. That's why.
That's why you're saying that.
Of course. So when we do it because Grandma did it. And Rabbi Yosef Tov Elam told her to do it. That's it. We don't need it. So hold on. Well, one more line. Rabbi Shimon, how does Rabbi Shimon respond to Rabbi Meir that the pasuk which you quoted was talking about srucha meikara, it was spoiled the minute I cut the meat up? How do I do? Rabbi Shimon, srucha meikara lo tzricha miyuta. If it's spoiled from the beginning, from the very first time that I slaughtered the animal, I don't need a pasuk to tell me I'm allowed to eat it. Why? Afra ba'almahu. It's as good as what? Dirt. It's diseased. It's disgusting. It never had a minute when anybody would eat it. I don't need a pasuk to teach me the halacha that if something was spoiled before anybody would consider it a part of a meal, it's already spoiled. The minute it comes off the hide of the animal, I don't need a pasuk to tell me that it's no good. It's like dirt. It's not meat, it's dirt. So therefore, when do I need a pasuk? When do I need a pasuk? When it was good initially. And then it started to deteriorate. That's when I need a pasuk to tell me that no sein ta'am lifgam is permissible. Is permissible. Now, I want to give you another illustration of where the original product will become the determining factor, besides nevela and trefa. There is a titanic machloket harishayinim as to whether or not notain tam lifgam, which we basically say is mutar, is it mutar on Pesach as well? So here is the case. I have a chametz pot, which I didn't use for 400 hours, didn't use it. And now I cook a soup, which is kosher l'Pesach, in this chametz pot. Are you allowed to eat the soup on Pesach or not? So what would you say based on what we learned tonight? What would you say?
No.
No, it's a machloikis. Rabbi, no. Now, so initially you'd say it's a machloikis. Rabbi Meir would say it's prohibited, and Rabbi Shimon would say it's permissible. However, how would you define the original absorption of the chametz 40 hours ago? Was that permissible or prohibited?
Permissible.
Almost all of us would say that chametz lifnei ha-Pesach was heter bala. What did absorb? Something that was permissible. Almost all of us would say that. Rambam doesn't agree with us. The Rambam believes that all year chametz is considered a prohibited item. Why is chametz considered a prohibited item when we're all allowed to eat chametz? How could it be a prohibited item? Because no, then it's only prohibited for those 7 days. He's saying tonight it's prohibited. Why? Correct. Because there is one place in the world where chametz is always prohibited. On the Mizbeach and the Beit HaMikdash. I told that to you. Good. The Torah says, Ki chol sa'or v'chol devash lo taktiru mimena isha l'Hashem. You're not allowed to put any sweeteners on the Mizbeach, dvash, and not allowed to put any yeast or sourdough on the Mizbeach, except for the couple of exceptions. There's Karban Shlomim and Karban Toda, Shtei Alechem. There are a couple of things, but those are exceptions to the rule. Otherwise, chametz is asur in the Beit HaMikdash. Therefore, Rambam, and no one, and the problem is, this is one of the cases where the Rambam didn't explicitly state it. You have to dream it and grub and finger to figure out what Shitas Rambam is, and it's on my list to ask Rambam. There are a couple of things which the Rambam could easily have just said 3 words and we know what he holds. But instead, he doesn't do that. I'm going to give you the most famous case. Whether mitzvot, tzrichot, kavana or not. Do you have to have kavana when you do a mitzvah that I'm doing it because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told me to do it? Do you have to have that thought in mind? It's the primary reason why we make a bracha before we do a mitzvah. Why do I have to say, Asher kedushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu al mikra megillah? Why do I have to say, l'hadlik ner shel Shabbat? Why? Because we want people to recognize, why am I doing it? But Rambam never ever tells us in so many words, mitzvot srichot kavanah. What he does is, he gives us cases. And of course, each case implies something else. And therefore, it has to be titanic machloikis. What is Shitas Rambam, and which is the exception? It is crazy. The Rambam writes, in relationship to this case, that if somebody crushes up a piece of matzah, crushes it up, walks into your house, opens up your mouth, and shoves the matzah down your throat, says the Rambam, you have fulfilled your obligation of eating matzah. That's where he paskins the opposite. So in the case of matzah, what would you say is the Rambam's opinion? Mitzvot ein srichot kavana. But as Cheryl says correctly, the Rambam says, if you happen to be walking by a shul, I have no intention of walking in, I'm going to the movies on Rosh Hashanah, and I hear the Baal Tekeah, and I don't have in mind to be Yotzei, I'm not Yotzei the mitzvah. The mere fact, I stop there and listen to all 100 sounds. I'm not Yotzei. until the Baal Tokeya has in mind to be Yotze you, and you have in mind to be Yotze the mitzvah. Well, you must hold mitzvah srichas kavana. Well, which one is it, Rambam? Why don't you just write three words, mitzvah srichas kavana? I'm going to ask him the same thing about chametz. Is chametz lifnei ha-pesach isura bala? It absorbed something that was asur? Or is chametz lifnei ha-pesach hetera bala? Ram didn't say it explicitly. So you have to kvetch and use your grubbin finger, go like this. Oh, I think this Rambam indicates one way. The other Rambam indicates the other way. That's why there are 200 books written about the Rambam. More books on the Rambam than any other Sefer that has been recorded in Jewish history. More on the Rambam than on the Talmud. It's unbelievable. And that's after the Rambam wrote his introduction, that once I've written my book, you don't need any more books. That's what he wrote. You don't need more books. I got all the whole halacha right here in front of you. You don't need more books. Because people misunderstood him. But anyhow, so Rabbi Shimon says, I don't need a pasuk for that. Srucha me'ikara is not called. So, if I hold that chametz lifnei ha-pesach has absorbed something prohibited, then if the halacha was like Rabbi Meir, then you would not be permitted to eat that kosher le-pesach soup that was cooked in a chametz pot, even though the last chametz that was used was 400 hours ago. But if chametz before Pesach is considered to absorb something that was mutar, then we paskin like Rabbi Shimon for sure that you're allowed to eat it. That you're allowed to eat it. Unless there's another issue involved. I don't want to get into that right now. There's another factor that you have to consider. That is, I'll tell it to you now, that when do we allow you to rely on notein tam lefgam b'di'eved? When? When the alternative is throw it in the garbage. That's the alternative. On Pesach, there's another alternative. Wait till after Pesach. Put it in your freezer and wait till after Pesach. After Pesach, you can eat chametz. What's the problem? What's the problem? So therefore, on Pesach, we actually paskin. All forms of bitul don't apply to Pesach. Because it's called a davar sheyeshlo matirin. We're going to do that sugya in great detail as a separate shir. We're going to give all the cases, many of the cases that are quoted in the Gemara. But let's move on to the Shulchan Aruch. That's the reason. Afilu be'elef. So correct.
It's a thing. It
isn't. That's another explanation. Because its punishment is bikaret.
Right.
So it's a serious offense.
Right. I thought even a little bit.
But the real reason is because it's a davar sheyesh lematirin. So therefore, even if you have one little piece of bread that falls into this huge pot of kosher le-pesach chicken soup, you're not allowed to eat it.
Right.
Not allowed to eat it. Because you can just wait till after yontif. Now, it's easy for us to say that we have refrigeration. In the time of the Gemara, most people couldn't wait with a soup to wait till after Yontif. It was the first day Yontif, would get spoiled. So then they were allowed to eat it. Because then the choice was either chuck it out or eat it. That's the choice.
So they changed that with the food.
Yes, that is correct.
But if you say you're just waiting, you know, put it in the freezer, that means you're owning chametz over the freezer.
No, you're not. Okay, but there is no... It's an interesting question. It's an interesting question. So the answer is, mid the oraita, it's not called chametz. Who said the davar sheyesh lematirin is not subject to bitul? The Rabbanan. But on a doraita, it's not called chametz, so for Bal Yerah and Bal Yimatzeh, I'm violating nothing. But it's an excellent question. Let's take a look at page 3. This is the name of the Siman, Siman Kuf Gimel in Yoredeya, Din Notein Tam Levgam. So we had a machloikis. Let's see what the halacha is. Kol davar sheta'amo pagum eino oser ta'aruvuto. This is not talking about necessarily just a pot. This is talking about an item that was not kosher. And now that it got mixed up in my pot, its time is detrimental. Under such situations, it is a no oser. It does not prohibit the entire mixture. The afilu ein ta'amo pagu machmat atzmo. Even if you were to isolate this piece of meat, let's say, and as a piece of meat, it tastes great. But it's now in the middle of chocolate pudding. In the middle of chocolate pudding, meat doesn't taste good. So that is ta'am pagum. Humut afilu ein ta'amo pagum, machmat atzmo. Shebifnei atzmo humut am umishubach. Alone, it's a great tasting piece of meat. Ela shepogein ta'aruvato. What impact did this kosher meat have? It had, or non-kosher meat, what impact did it have? It ruined the mixture. Chocolate pudding and meat don't taste very well. Under those circumstances, it is mutar. It is mutar. Adds the Ramah. Mihu, however, divarim hachashuvim, things that are what? Unusually significant. Such as ki berya. Ki berya. Berya is a whole item. For example, a bug. Grasshopper. Okay? People used to eat grasshoppers. Because obviously they taste good. So if you have a grasshopper, that's a small one, less than a kezias. Normally, if something is less than a kezias, we don't particularly care. It's tight, it's considered insignificant. And is certainly subject to the laws of bitul. But if something is a beria, a whole item, that is never subject to the laws of bitul. Never. Because since it was whole, it can't forfeit its unique qualities. So if you have something which is a beria, or kayotzeba, or something else that might be unusually significant, there is another siman a couple of pages later called Chaticha Haru'uya Lehitkabei. Chaticha Haru'uya Lehitkabei. What do you think it means? Just think of the three words. What do you think it means? Lehitkabei.
It looked nice enough, though.
That what?
It looked like it was nice if you would serve it to somebody.
Not just anybody.
To somebody.
A distinguished guest. It was a piece of meat that what? That was suitable for a distinguished guest. That piece of meat, even if it gets mixed up with something else, even if there are 1,000 times against it, it does not become batel. It does not become batel. Why? We'll learn. It's a separate siman in Shulchan Aruch called Chaticha, but that's what he has in mind. O kayotzeba. Beria is one example. O chaticha haru she'eharuya litkabed. Im einan pigumin ba'atzman. If this piece of meat, or the little grasshopper, in and of itself is not detrimental, it tastes great. Afal pi shepogmin hatavshil. Even though they ruin the taste of what? The chocolate pudding, because chocolate pudding with a grasshopper taste doesn't taste good, and chocolate pudding with a meaty taste doesn't taste good. Under those circumstances, einam bitelim afilu be'elef. They will not become batel even if the ratio is 1,000 to 1. And under those circumstances, notein tam livgam does not work. So even though Caro ruled unequivocally, unequivocally, every single notein tam lifgam is permissible. That's what he writes. Mutar. Mutar means, you know, it's, what is the word, does mutar mean lechatchila or only b'di'eved? Lechatchila. According to Caro, you are allowed to take a pot that hasn't been used in 24 hours. Non-kosher meat, a piece of meat was cooked in this pot. You wait 24 hours, you can cook your meat there. You're allowed to. Because no tain tam lefgam is mutter. Under all circumstances. Says the Rama, hold your horses. Number one, if it's a beria, or I gave you chaticha haruya litkabed, maybe even a dover sheyesh lo matirin. The Rama says there are certain times when we will not rely on the license of notain tam lefgam. Even if it is lefgam, it still remains asur. Says Karo, continuing in halacha bet. Pigamzeh, this detriment that we are speaking, ain tsarich sheyivgom legamre. It doesn't mean that it has to be totally disgusting. Achiyeh kotz. Kotz means disgusting. Vayakutsu mipnei b'nei Yisrael. The Egyptian, we became disgusting in the Egyptian eyes. Kotz lachlo. Ela afilu pargeim kitsat. Even if it just has a slightly ruined taste, a pogame kitsat, eino oser ta'aruvoto. It does not prohibit what? It does not prohibit its mixture. V'yesh mi she'omer, and others disagree what I just said, and say, Dehainu dafka kishinit arev isur mu'at im heter meruba. This is only if a little isur got mixed up with what? A lot of heter. Aval isur meruba l'toch heter mu'at afilu mechza al mechza ein omrim notain tam lifgam mutar ad she yifgom legamre. So under those circumstances, he says it depends how much. What was the ratio between the davar ha'asur and the davar ha'amutar? So now, here comes a rule that you have to remember. Karo himself quoted two opinions. In the first opinion, which we read 2 minutes ago, did Karo make a distinction? How much of the mutar and how much of the asur? Did he say anything of the sort? No. Now he quotes v'yesh misha omer. Karo many times quotes a second opinion. The rule of Pinky is that Karo himself accepts the first opinion. Yosef Karo himself, when asked, would say the halacha is like the first opinion. So why does he quote the second opinion, which disagrees with his first opinion? Out of deference to who might have said it. I've told you on many occasions, Karo used three previous codes to determine the final halacha. Okay, Karo lived in the 15th century. He didn't make up anything himself. He took Rambam, Rif, Yitzchak Alfasi, who's printed in the back of the Gemara, and the Rush, also printed in the back of the Gemara. And whoever had two out of three on his side, that's how Karo quoted the halacha. But often, when one of them were outvoted, let's assume it was Rambam and Rush against the Rif, he'll quote V'yesh Omrim, because it's one of his two Sephardic clansmen, Rambam or Rif. But if it's Rambam and Rif against the Rush, he doesn't bother giving the Rush. He's the Ashkenaz boy, what does he know? He's an Ashkenaz guy. He doesn't do that. So sometimes there are other great Rishonim that from time to time, Karo, simply out of deference to record their opinion, makes note of it. Makes note of it. And it's significant that he does. Because there are times when a Rav, a Posek, under certain extreme conditions, can rely on that second opinion, even though that's not the mainstream halacha. Even though it's not the mainstream halacha. We have this in many areas of halacha. Many areas. Quite a number of them are regarding, hilchot nida, where there is a position which is the public practice position, but to this particular person who asked the question, you're makel, right? There are many such situations. Many. So that's what he writes. And he quotes a couple of other situations that I don't want to go through all of the details. I want to go to to the Ramah, where it's the right where it says at the end of the regular print, which is Karo, Hagoha. That's the Ramah. Yesh Omrim Afogav Teha Isur Livgam V'hama'achal Mutar Mikol Makom Hakideira Asura. The pot's usher. Says the Rama, if you cooked something, right, you had a mixture of this davar, a piece of meat is cooking in your chocolate pudding, and it's tam lifgam. So I'm going to allow your kiddies to eat what? The chocolate pudding. I'm going to allow them to eat the chocolate pudding if they eat their fish. Right? That's what my mother used to threaten me every Thursday night. I hated fish. She says, if you don't eat the fish, you don't get the chocolate pudding. It's every Thursday night. It's fried fish. So flounder I could take, but once you make carp, I couldn't take it. But I had to stuff it down my throat because I always wanted the chocolate pudding.
And now you can just eat the chocolate pudding.
That is correct. Now I don't have to worry about that. Correct. So here's the Ramah says, Ashkenazim, okay, you can eat the chocolate pudding, but you can't use that pot anymore. It has to be, but it has to be koshered. The pot has to be koshered. So what is the Ramah telling me here? That I rely only on notain tam lifgam bidyeved. Meaning it was done already. The chocolate pudding was cooked with the meaty taste coming out. Okay, it was done. But now to use this pot next time, knowing that what type of a taste is going to come out, a detrimental meaty taste into the next time that I cook my chocolate pudding? Absolutely not. Can't do that. You have to kosher the pot first. So here is a significant difference between Sfardim and Ashkenazim. Sfardim will never have to kosher the pot because they rely on the Ikar Halacha as Karo does 90% of the time. And the Halacha is Rabbi Shimon is correct. Rabbi Meir has been rejected. Notain tam lifgam is mutar. Karo Ramah doesn't want to go so far, and it's not the Ramah. There were plenty of Chachmei Ashkenaz who actually said this way before the Ramah was born, and he, the Ramah, just quotes all of these people. All of these people. And the people on the side tell you who those individuals are. Who they are. Who they are. Yeah. Fine. So that's one chumrah of the Ramah. And he writes, V'im bishlu ba'achakach toch me'et le'et tavshil shaho'isa risho notein bo l'shvach Ne'esar hatavshil hasheni afilu im lo haya bo samach, says the Ramah. What happens if I didn't listen to you? I didn't listen to the Mr. Ramah. And I took out that pot within 24 hours and I cooked another chocolate pudding, knowing full well that what was that piece of meat that I, the meat that was cooked in this pot, it was Lifgam vis-a-vis the chocolate pudding. Now that you did it a second time, what does the Ramah say? The tavshil is asur. You're not allowed to eat the chocolate pudding.
Because it wasn't really good.
Because now it's not, that's correct. Because even though now you say, hey, I cooked it. Oh, no. Unless one condition, there was 60 times more chocolate pudding than what? Than the taste of the meat. Then we apply the normal rules of bitul. Then, even if it was not livgam, it would be batel anyhow. If you have real meat in a chocolate pudding, if there is 60 times more chocolate pudding and you can't see the meat, you're allowed to eat the chocolate pudding. So if there are 60 times more, then the Ramah says I'll allow it. But if you don't have 60 times and you didn't listen to me, the next time you cook in that pot, even though it was lifgam, if you did it and you didn't listen to me, I'm going to prohibit the product itself. I don't care if your alternative is to what?
Throw it out.
Doesn't bother me. I'm going to be machmir to enforce my position, says the Rambam. And that's the way we pasken.
If it's 60 times more than the pot is fine.
60 times more, not than the pot, than the bleah, than the food.
But it's just the taste of the food.
Okay, so we said that. How do you measure the taste? Against the amount of size the meat was that you cooked in this pot initially.
But what about the pot? After you eat the food, I get that. But what about the
food? No, you can't eat the food in this case.
Oh,
so what happens to the pot? It still has, it's now comes next time as bidi evan.
You can always have to make a lot of chocolate.
If your habit is to make it with a meat base, yes, you'll have to make a lot of chocolate pudding. That is correct.
If you don't want to. You're still going to have to cash your pot.
If you don't want
to. Yeah. All right. We'll stop here. And we'll continue with this next week, as well as moving on.